From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel. Over the past few months, polls show that fewer Americans say they believe humans are making the planet dangerously warmer. And that is despite a raft of scientific reports that say otherwise. And that puzzles many climate scientists, but not social scientists. As NPR's Christopher Joyce reports, some of their research suggests that when people encounter new information, facts may not be as important as beliefs.
The divide between climate believers and disbelievers can be as wide as a West Virginia valley, and that's where two of them squared off recently at a public debate on West Virginia Public Radio. Coal company president Don Blankenship is a doubter.
It's a hoax because it clearly anyone that says that they know what the temperature is going to of the Earth's going to be in 2020 or 2030 needs to be put in an asylum because they don't.
On the other side, environmentalist Robert Kennedy Jr.
98% of the research climatologists in the world say that global warming is real, that its impact's going to be catastrophic. There are 2% who disagree with that. I have a choice of believing the 98% or the 2%.
For social scientist and lawyer Don Brayman, it's not surprising that two people can disagree so strongly over science. Brayman is on the faculty at George Washington University and a part of a research group called Cultural Cognition.
People tend to conform their factual beliefs to ones that are consistent with their cultural outlook, their worldview.
Brayman's group has conducted several experiments to back that up. First, they ask people to describe their cultural beliefs. Some embrace new technology, authority, and free enterprise, the so-called individualistic group. Others are suspicious of authority or of commerce and industry. Brayman calls them communitarians. In one experiment, Brayman then queried his subjects about something unfamiliar, nanotechnology, new research into tiny molecule-sized objects that could lead to novel products.
These two groups start to polarize as soon as you start to describe some of the potential benefits and harms.
The individualists tended to like nanotechnology. The communitarians generally viewed it as dangerous, all based on the same information.
It doesn't matter whether you show them negative or positive information. They reject the information that is contrary to what they would like to believe, and they glom onto the positive information.
So what's going on here?
Basically, the reason that people react in a closed-minded way to information is that the implications of it threaten their values.
That's Dan Kahan, a law professor at Yale University and a member of Cultural Cognition. He says people test new information against their pre-existing view of how the world should work.
If the implication, the outcome, can affirm your values, you think about it in a much more open-minded way.
And if the information doesn't, you tend to reject it. In another experiment, people read a United Nations study about the dangers of global warming. Then the researcher said, okay, the solution is to regulate pollution from industry. Many in the individualistic group then rejected the climate science. But when more nuclear power was offered as the solution,
they said, you know, it turns out global warming is a serious problem.
And for the communitarians, climate danger seemed less serious if the only solution was more nuclear power. Then there's the messenger effect. In an experiment dealing with the dangers versus benefits of a vaccine, the scientific information came from several people. They ranged from a rumpled and bearded expert to a crisply businesslike one, and people tended to believe the message that came from the person they considered to be more like them. Which brings us back to climate.
If you have people who are skeptical of the data on climate change, you can bet that Al Gore is not going to convince them at this point.
So should climate scientists hire, say, Newt Gingrich as their spokesman? Dan Kahan says no.
The goal can't be to create a kind of psychological house of mirrors so that people end up seeing exactly what you want. The goal has to be to create an environment that allows them to be open-minded.
And Kahan says you can't do that just by publishing more scientific data. Christopher Joyce, NPR News.
ABC News will be covering the California governor's race with a shrunken staff. Network executives say that economic pressures on the news industry are forcing them to shed up to 25% of the news staff of the news source that I grew up watching. As NPR's David Folkenflik reports, ABC says it intends to use the cuts to reinvent itself.
ABC News President David Westin says it's a new digital day.
We're looking to use what technology has made possible in recent months and years to fundamentally transform the way we both gather the news and produce the news.
But he readily acknowledges another point, too.
And yes, do it with fewer people and at a reduced cost.
And there you have it. ABC News is offering voluntary buyout packages to hundreds of journalists, hoping to reduce staff by up to a quarter of its 1,400-person workforce. The pressures aren't all that new. Cable and the web have hurt old-line news outlets. ABC's World News still draws about 8 million viewers a night, second only to NBC Nightly News, but that's down a lot from what it used to be. So advertising revenues were hurt even before the current recession. David Westin.
ABC News has kept its head above water, but sometimes just barely so. And looking out in the future, I was very concerned, and particularly last year in a down advertising year, it drove home the concern that we were a bit precarious. And part of my job is to make sure that we are a robust, successful news organization going well out into the future.
Some of the changes won't be noticed by many viewers. For instance, the weekend editions of Good Morning America and World News have been folded into their weekday counterparts under a single executive. But ABC is also placing great emphasis on new digital platforms. Producers should be able to edit and transmit footage from the field. Reporters should learn how to shoot using new compact digital cameras. ABC has already experimented with that model using younger digital reporters scattered across the globe. And Westin promises quality will be preserved. He points to the resurrection of Nightline in the ratings after it embraced a quicker-paced format and a more nimble approach to reporting stories with digital cameras.
That's exactly what I'd expect him to say.
Bob Zelnick was a correspondent based in Moscow and Tel Aviv for ABC News, and he also covered the Pentagon. He's been critical of the big networks for what he says is a liberal bias. But he says that slant is far outweighed by a proud tradition of covering the big stories, like the civil rights movement, the Vietnam War, and the fall of communism. Zelnick says knowledge and skill will necessarily be lost.
When you do this, when you cut back on staff and start to cut down on your correspondent corps, which is probably the next step in this, it's like a marooned person trying to sustain himself by eating his own flesh.
But digital news guru Mark Glazer of PBS says the network's survival depends on making the significant transformation outlined by Westin yesterday.
A lot of other organizations have paid a lot of lip service and said, okay, we're going to do mobile content, we're going to have digital journalists, we're going to have mobile journalists, we're going to try all these things. But, you know, it just depends on how much, you know, they really are going to make it an institution-wide change.
Glazer says the erosion of audiences is testing the very viability of the network news model.
This is definitely a sink or swim evolutionary kind of moment where, you know, it's evolve or die.
That's an assessment that Westin didn't really duck yesterday when asked about pressures from ABC's corporate owners.
You know, it's funny. The folks in Los Angeles at Disney are very powerful people, but the forces we're dealing with here are actually more powerful even than they are.
The buyouts are not offered to correspondents and anchors working under personal services contracts, but executives say they will take a harder look as those contracts expire. David Folkenflik, NPR News, New York.
Everyone has one, something you find particularly annoying in the way some people talk, whether it's a mispronunciation, a grammatical mistake, a pretentious bit of jargon, or a tired cliche. When it comes to language, says our linguist Jeff Nunberg, we all have our pet peeves.
My friend Scott is always sending me indignant emails with examples of people using the word equation to mean just a situation with a lot of factors, where nothing's actually being equated, as in, family members are a critical part of the doctor-patient equation. I tell him I think of this as just routine journalistic bloat, and not even he thinks it's a threat to the Republic. But he enjoys grousing about it all the more because it doesn't seem to annoy anybody else that much. It makes for a fine pet peeve. Of course, I have peeves of my own. When I hear people say oversimplistic, I suspect they don't know that simplistic means that all by itself. I'd be happy if somebody would drive arguably and quite possibly into the sea. And it seems to me it's almost always a bad idea to begin a sentence with, I pride myself on. A pet peeve should be like a pet theory or a pet story, a tic or fancy that you nurture in your bosom and make your own. You can have a pet peeve about people who mispronounce mascarpone. But it's odd to use the phrase for off-the-rack gripes that everybody shares. Saying that you have a pet peeve about thinking outside the box or your call is important to us is like saying you have a pet theory that you should feed a cold and starve a fever. I have this notion that gingerly shouldn't be used as an adverb, as in she hugged the child gingerly, because there's no corresponding adjective ginger. You wouldn't say she gave the child a ginger hug. I'll concede that gingerly has been used as an adverb for 400 years, and nobody's ever complained about it before. But so much the better. Every time I see the word used as an adverb, I can take a quiet satisfaction in knowing that I'm marching to a more logical drummer than the 500 million other speakers of English who haven't yet cottoned to the problem. Writers tend to have lots of these notions. Kingsley Amis held that it was incorrect to use pristine to mean pure rather than original, and that you shouldn't say, I was oblivious to the noise, since oblivious can only mean forgetful. And in a usage book he published a few years ago, Bill Bryson contended that it was wrong to use expectorate as a synonym for spit, since it really means to cough up phlegm from the chest. The word did originally mean that, but it's been used to mean spit since Dickens's day. And Bryson knows perfectly well that it would be completely unreasonable to insist on the original meaning. Think of the mischief it would work with Major League Baseball's Rule 8.02, which says that the pitcher shall not expectorate on the ball. But Bryson also understands that it's the very unreasonableness of the argument that makes it so handy to have around when the dinner conversation flags. Nobody ever took this quite so far as the 19th century writer and journalist Ambrose Bierce. He's best remembered today for his stories and his satirical Devil's Dictionary. But in 1909, he wrote a book called Write It Right, A Little Blacklist of Literary Faults. It was republished for its centenary last year with entertaining annotations by Jan Freeman, who writes the language column for the Boston Globe. Bierce had a gift for discerning usage errors where no one else would have thought there was anything amiss. Take the sentence, since I made no money last year, I had to live in a dilapidated shack with a dirt floor with 10 other people. By Bierce's lights, that sentence contains 5 errors. You should say earn money, not make money. Last year should be the previous year. Dilapidated shouldn't be used for a wood structure, since it comes from the Latin word for stone. Dirt shouldn't be used to mean earth. And you shouldn't use people with a specific number. It should be 10 other persons. That makes Bierce sound like a caricature of a humorless pedant. But he clearly enjoyed being perverse and ornery. And my guess is that his journalist colleagues wouldn't have taken any of this too seriously. Oh, that's just Ambrose being Ambrose. The weird thing is to see rules like these passed down as traditional linguistic wisdom. Take that edict that you ought to say 10 persons rather than 10 people. You can still find it in the recent editions of Strunk and White's revered Elements of Style, along with antique admonitions against saying contact us or calling something worthwhile. The linguist Arnold Zwicky calls these zombie rules. Somebody should have run them through a wood chipper long ago, but here we are in 2010 assigning students a style guide that tells them that correct English requires them to write there were 5,000 screaming persons at the Lady Gaga concert. It's bad enough that that leaves students with the impression that mastering good usage requires them to learn an esoteric code. But it also robs those rules of the kinky charm they had when they were merely somebody's quizzical peeves. Now those personal crotchets are being offered as authorized standards, as if you could decree the tune the language is obliged to dance to. But the English language doesn't owe anybody a living. It was here first.
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist who teaches at the School of Information at the University of California at Berkeley.
We're going to spend the next few minutes on a problem college campuses have been facing for a long time now, yet the statistics continue to be chilling. A study funded by the U.S. Department of Justice estimates that 1 out of 5 college women will be sexually assaulted. Usually there's alcohol involved. NPR's investigative unit teamed up with journalists at the Center for Public Integrity for this look at how schools and the government agency that oversees them handle these cases. NPR's Joseph Shapiro reports.
When a woman is sexually assaulted on a college campus, her most common reaction is to keep it quiet. Laura Dunn says she stayed quiet about what happened in April of 2004, her freshman year at the University of Wisconsin.
I always thought that rape was when, you know, someone got attacked by a stranger and you had to fight back.
That night, Dunn was drinking so many raspberry vodkas that they cut her off at the frat house party. Still, she knew and trusted the two men who took her back to a house. That's where she says they raped her as she passed in and out of consciousness.
I guess I didn't want to believe what actually happened.
It just didn't make sense with the way she saw her life. For one thing, she had a boyfriend. They'd been dating for 4 years.
We're getting close to marriage. We had been waiting together. So I was still a virgin, and it just didn't fit with what I wanted my life to be and what I had planned my life to be. So I just kind of pushed it to the side, said, you know, this is this bad incident that happened, and it was just a mistake. You know, we were all drunk, and I just chose to, like, put it there.
She focused on her schoolwork, but she couldn't sleep. She lost weight. She broke up with her boyfriend without ever telling him about the attack. And she didn't report it. 15 months later, she was sitting in class. The professor was talking about how, in wartime, rape is used as a weapon of terror.
And this professor, who I'll forever respect, stopped the lecture and said, you know, I want to talk about rape on this campus.
The professor said that over 80% of victims stay silent.
She said, I want you to know that this has happened in my class to my students, and that there is something you can do about it, and there is someone you can talk about it with. And she told me about the dean of students. And after hearing, you know, about rape, I just decided, you know, I know it was rape, and now I know that there's something I can do about it. And so the moment that lecture let up, I walked across to the dean of students' office, and I reported that day.
We'll tell you what happened to Laura Dunn in a moment. But first, it helps to know something about the history of how colleges and universities got their current-day responsibility to investigate and prevent sexual assaults. It starts with a crime in April of 1986.
What happened to Jean was so amazingly unreal.
Connie Cleary is the mother of Jean Cleary.
She was in the right place where she should have been, in her own bed, in the dorm at 6 o'clock in the morning, fast asleep. There were 3 automatically locking doors that should have been locked, which she thought were locked. And she didn't have an enemy in the world. And Lehigh was such a safe-looking place, you know?
Jean Cleary was 19, a freshman at Lehigh University. A stranger, he was a student, raped, tortured, and strangled her. In their grief, Connie Cleary and her husband devoted the rest of their lives to making college campuses safer.
So if it happened to Jean, it could certainly happen to somebody else. And that's why I decided I had to do something to save others from such a horror.
Connie's husband, Howard, sold his successful business to underwrite their work. Connie, who'd been terrified of speaking in public, went on TV morning shows and testified before lawmakers. Their idea was simple: force schools to disclose all crime that happens on campus. Then students and their parents would be informed. And the campus would get safer because, under public scrutiny, college presidents would have no choice but to get serious about preventing crime. 20 years ago, Congress passed that disclosure law, now known as the Jean Cleary Act. There's been success. Over a recent 10-year period, violent crime on college campuses dropped by 9%.
The Department of Education has been a disappointment to me.
But for advocates like Connie Cleary, there have been shortcomings, too. The U.S. Department of Education regulates schools under the Cleary Act, but it's fined offending schools just 6 times. And that gets us back to Laura Dunn's case. She counted on the Department of Education for help.
Dear Ms. Dunn, on August 8, 2006, the U.S. Department of Education Office of Civil Rights, received your complaint of discrimination on the basis of sex filed against the University of Wisconsin-Madison.
By the time Dunn reported to campus officials, one of the men she accused had graduated. The other said the sex was consensual. The University of Wisconsin took 9 months to investigate, then decided against punishment. As a last resort, Dunn asked the U.S. Department of Education to find that the university had failed in its responsibility to act promptly and to end the sexual harassment she faced being on campus with her alleged attacker. This anti-harassment law is among the strongest tools for enforcement at the Education Department. Few women know to use it, and when they do, the department rarely acts. Between 1998 and 2008, it ruled against just 5 universities out of 24 complaints. That's according to records obtained through the Freedom of Information Act by the Center for Public Integrity. There was no punishment in those cases, simply guidance on how to improve campus procedures. Presented with those findings, Rosalyn Alley, the Assistant Secretary for Civil Rights, says her office is stepping up outreach to students so they know their rights, and assistance to schools so they know their responsibilities.
We want them to get training. We want to provide some help so that the adults and the students alike can ensure that this plague, it's really become a plague in this country, begins to diminish.
The Education Department official says she's willing to take steps not used by her predecessors, to withdraw federal funding from offending schools and refer cases to the Department of Justice for possible prosecution. Laura Dunn is a teacher now. She writes the next day's lesson on the blackboard.
Most days we'll have students will be able to find interior angles of triangles.
2 years after Laura Dunn graduated, a thick document came in the mail to her apartment. It was the finding by the Department of Education.
I went straight to the conclusion.
It said the University of Wisconsin, despite taking 9 months on the case, had acted properly. Defeated, Dunn didn't read on. She threw the papers on the top of a pile of other documents in the corner of her bedroom.
You know, I could have fought it again, and I could have appealed, but that would have meant I would have had to read it. And at that point in my life, just reading it, I just didn't even want to. I did not want to read the ugly things that people said.
But Laura Dunn is no longer silent. She's a leader in a national grassroots campaign to get rape survivors to speak out in public. Joseph Shapiro, NPR News.
To learn more about victims' rights and find resources for campus safety, visit npr.org. By just about every measure, Team USA has exceeded expectations at these Winter Games. And even though some results are known long before the nightly TV broadcast, viewers are still tuning in by the millions. Commentator Frank DeFord says that's given NBC an unexpected victory.
The Winter Olympics are basically a TV show, and thus NBC, which has become the New Jersey Nets of networks, actually won the game's most important gold medal one night last week, podiumed, as we unfortunately actually say now, when it whipped American Idol in the ratings. What was so revealing about this victory was that the featured attraction was Lindsey Vonn's victory in the downhill, which, of course, had happened hours beforehand and was thus in this internet world already known to most viewers. Evidently, we would now rather revel in an assured triumph than suffer through a live competition with a problematic outcome. Perhaps this suggests that at this time when there is so little good news in America, when we do not enjoy the everyday success we used to rather expect, when we are so at loggerheads as a people, that there is something comforting about us coming together to watch a beautiful young woman struggling with injury, secure in our knowledge that she will raise old glory on high. Every now and then, sports truly might reflect some greater meaning. Of course, like us Americans, the Winter Games have themselves changed so much. It wasn't that long ago that they bivouacked in precious little alpine villages where we all but expected everyone to arrive in reindeer sleighs and then yodel. Now they've moved to ordinary big cities, which just happen to have some mountains down the road apiece. Folks were troubled when the temperatures in Vancouver crept into the 50s. The 2014 Games are in Sochi, Russia. Know what the temperature was there one day last week? 73. Why, we might as well hold the indoor games in some place most convenient for TV. New York, say, or Hollywood, with the mountain stuff on location out in Aspen or Crested Butte. This business of jamming everything into one place just because the Greeks kept things in Olympia seems so outdated today. Whatever, these next few nights are probably the swan song for NBC's winter bacchanalia. ESPN, with all its cable riches and its Disney network partner ABC, will undoubtedly win the contract for Sochi and Rio, too, for the summer of 16. But if NBC does lose the Olympics, we lose Bob Costas as the interlocutor. ESPN hasn't anybody even near his ability to do this unique thing that he does so well night after night. You'll have no idea how good Costas is till you see somebody else try to do it.
Commentator Frank DeFord joins us on Wednesdays. And this is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montagne.
And I'm Steve Inskeep.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Robert Siegel. President Obama has finally released his health care plan. It includes a controversial excise tax, the so-called Cadillac tax, on high-end health insurance plans. NPR's Joanne Silberner reports on how that tax would work.
First, you've got to understand the basics. The proposed tax would be on the most expensive health insurance plans, many of which let you go to any doctor anytime you want for free. Many of the people who have these plans are union members who bargained away wages in return for the rich benefits, and many are well-off people who can afford the plans. There is a purpose to taxing just the Cadillac plans, says Henry Aaron, a senior economist at the Brookings Institution.
What it is expected to do is to discourage employers from providing compensation through these hyper-generous health insurance plans.
The idea is to get employers to offer lower-cost plans and avoid the tax, and presumably give workers the difference in higher wages. Lower-cost health plans are good, says Henry Aaron. With their co-payments and deductibles, they'd make doctors and patients more cost-conscious.
If providers know that patients face some cost for the care they receive, they have an incentive to provide that care more in a more cost-effective way.
And patients would be cost-conscious as well, he says. Aaron is a liberal economist. Conservative economist Gail Wilensky also likes the idea of an excise tax on health insurance.
Well, it's a good thing in that health care is expensive, and you want to have people think about how much they're spending on health care relative to how much they spend on all the other necessities and luxuries of life.
So after much discussion last year, the Senate included a health insurance excise tax, but the House did not. One reason, says Lawrence Michel of the Economic Policy Institute, fairness.
Part of the problem is that plans which cost a lot may cost a lot because people in those plans live in high-cost areas, that they are older and sicker. And high-cost plans are not necessarily ones that are just rich in the benefits provided to people.
In his effort to rein in health care costs, Mr. Obama went ahead and included the tax in his new proposal, but in a scaled-back way. It doesn't kick in till 2018, 5 years after the Senate plan would have, and he significantly increased the premium cost at which the tax would kick in. Economist Gail Wilensky says the changes water it down too much.
In a health care reform legislation package that has had precious few cost containment measures, they've taken one of the few cost containment measures and made it much weaker than it's been. It's really disappointing.
But economist Henry Aaron says at least it's something.
I'd like it to be tighter than it is, but if this is all that the political system is able to produce at this point, it certainly is better than the status quo.
The unions fought fiercely against the Senate plan, but they're willing to live with this one. They help negotiate the details. Andy Stern heads the 2.2 million member SEIU.
The Obama plan is a big step forward. I think it's, you know, takes us 90% of the way there, and I think he did a very responsible job. Yeah, we can support it.
Which is a start as far as compromises go. But there are plenty of moving parts in the Obama plan, leaving the fate of the excise tax uncertain. Joanne Silberner, NPR News.